Have you ever thought about what it would take for you to like really believe? I don't know if you've ever wondered about this. Like you look at your life and you think, man, like I believe in God. But like if I really believed that Jesus is who he said he is, like my life would look different. Something would be different if I really truly believed. But then there's still that question of like, what would it take? What would I need to like get me to that place where I truly believe? And maybe you've heard some of the answers to this kind of question. So some have said that if God would just speak audibly, right, with that booming voice from heaven, man, I would believe. Or if God would just give me that undeniable sign, that thing that would for sure make me believe, then I'm in. That would be it. That would be all I would need. Or if God, and you could fill in the blank here, right, but would release me from my addiction, from my pain, from my lust, from my, like, whatever that thing is that's held you captive, like, that would be it. That is what I would need. It would, in my freedom, I would believe. Or if God would just heal or protect this person that I love, then I would know that I could trust him. I don't know if any of these sound familiar to you. I remember a time when I thought, if I could just touch the ground, see it with my own eyes, the ground where Jesus walked, like if I could go there and connect with these stories in a deeper way, like then I would really believe. In 2008, I went to Israel and I saw and I touched and I sat by like the very pool where Jesus came and found a man who had been an invalid for 38 years. Taylor was just there. I was in that place. I had a picture, and then like as I was wrapping up, I realized, dang it, that picture was the wrong pool. And I didn't have time to go back and get the picture of the other pool. You could tell how memorable this moment was for me, how much it has sustained me like in this powerful way, right? But this pool where Jesus says to this man, like, get up, take up your bed and walk. Like this place was real, and there I sat by it. And like I was aware in that moment that God had done something mighty in that place. But like, was it enough to help me really and truly believe? Could this moment, this experience, this place really be the foundation of my faith in Jesus? Signs and voices and deliverance and evidence. Right? Do any of these connect with you as something you've looked for or hoped for or longed for in your life? And if so, I mean, the question then becomes, are these the foundation of your faith? If not, what is the foundation of your faith? Like, what is it that compels you to believe, to truly believe? The Gospel of John was written to help you really and truly believe. If you have your Bibles with you, if you turn to John chapter 20, this is not what we read this morning. Chapter 20, the end of the Gospel, verse 30. We're jumping way ahead. But this verse, these verses is where we hear the author of the book of John telling us in his own words why he has written this book. And it's good for us to keep this in mind, the author's purpose as we read, as we hear week after week, as we read in our daily study. So chapter 20, verse 30, we hear this. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. The Gospel of John was written so that you may believe. And this belief is pretty specific. The Gospel of John isn't just hoping that we will all share some generic belief in a like vague God who hopefully is out there looking over us. Although, ironically, studies that are based on like interviewing Americans reveal that the majority of Americans who identify as Christian describe a belief in this very sort of vague God who watches over us like a cosmic lifeguard and who wants us to just be nice to each other. The Gospel of John has a much more specific God in mind. John has been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. 2 weeks ago, I introduced us to these titles that show up throughout John's gospel. We started by hearing John the Baptizer, who says about Jesus, this, as Jesus shows up, point, this is the Son of God. And then a guy named Andrew, one of John's disciples, John the Baptizer has his own disciples, and Andrew is one of them, and they see Jesus, and he hears John's testimony about him, and Andrew leaves John the Baptizer and joins Jesus. And as he's begun to follow Jesus for himself, Andrew decides he needs to find his brother. And so he goes and he finds Simon Peter, and when he finds Peter, Simon says, "We have found the Messiah." These two titles, Messiah and Son of God, they are already linked at the beginning of the gospel, and now we hear them linked again at the end of the gospel. In fact, when the gospel says, so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, these two titles are tied together in a way that makes them impossible to pull apart. It's not the Messiah and the Son of God. It's the Messiah, the Son of God. When I introduced these two titles 2 weeks ago, one of the things I said is it's not enough for us to just say, I believe Jesus is God's Son. Or, I believe Jesus is the Messiah. It's not enough because John's gospel sets out to fill these titles with specific meaning. To believe, there must be something, some sort of understanding of what we are believing and why, and what difference it makes for us. And our passage this morning dives into, you may have already heard it because the language was so prominent all throughout, what does it mean that Jesus is the Son of God? In other places in John's gospel, we'll hear more about the Messiah, but this passage is focused on the Son of God. And so we wonder, what does it mean to call Jesus the Son of God? And what does it mean to believe this, to trust that Jesus is the Son of God? And I want to make a suggestion for you, because, and maybe you've heard this as you've been in your small groups, as you've been talking with people about this gospel, but the Gospel of John sounds really weird to us. Right? Like there's something strange about John. And I think part of that is that we often bring our own fully formed ideas and definitions to John. And we assume that John is saying what we think before we've heard him. So like we already have an idea of what it means to say that Jesus is the Son of God. And so we read John expecting the gospel to say what we already think, but John doesn't really do that. And so it sounds strange because there are all of these parts that don't quite fit with the definitions we bring in. And we can see this in John 5. Jesus has just healed this man by the pool called Bethesda. the picture I had for you was the pool of Siloam. And I was like, ah, wrong pool. But I realized it beforehand, so that was good. Saved myself. But in a couple weeks, we'll be in chapter 9, and so I'll show you the pool of Siloam. And I'm in that picture, so that's kind of cool. And some of Jesus's fellow Jews are concerned about this healing. I mean, first of all, that should strike us, right? Like, can you imagine like watching somebody like truly be healed in front of you and you're like, this is a problem. But he was doing it on the Sabbath. So in verse 17, Jesus answers, he answers them. And Jesus says, my Father is working until now, and I am working. Not a big deal, right? Jesus, verse 18 then clarifies the issue. In verse 18, we read that this was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill Jesus. Because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. We hear this. Jesus was making himself equal with God. And we're tempted to take it at face value. We accept the idea that by calling God his own Father, he was making himself equal with God. Right? Most Christians who come to the Gospel of John often come with the idea that Jesus is God, that Jesus is divine. We've been told this. We believe this. It's thoroughly substantiated throughout the rest of Scripture. And so it's easy for us to accept the idea that Jesus is not only making himself equal with God, but that he himself is God. And so there's a lot more happening here, or so we imagine. And so when these people in the story, they hear Jesus and they think that he is blaspheming and they want to kill him for it, we like kind of mock them because they don't understand. Well, they don't understand that Jesus is not just making himself equal with God, but he is God. And so we make fun of them for not quite understanding the full reality. But there's this interesting problem with reading it this way. Jesus hasn't done this. Calling God your Father doesn't make you equal with God. It never has. Just as calling yourself a son of God doesn't mean that you think that you are somehow divine. Now, I don't want you to get me wrong here. I am not saying that Jesus isn't divine, that he isn't God. Like, there's an overwhelming number of passages that make this claim powerfully. It's just that this isn't one of them. But if we hear the language of Son of God, and we assume that Son of God means that Jesus is God, Jesus is divine, we are going to miss what Jesus is actually saying and be confused. When Jesus calls God his Father, he is not saying that he's equal to God. The point of this entire passage is that God's own people do not understand what it means to be a Son of God. And this is an epic tragedy. And I want to show you why. Jesus goes on to define sonship. And in verse 19, he says it this way. Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing, and greater works than these will he show him, so that you may marvel. So what does it mean to be the Son of God, the Son of the Father? It's actually pretty straightforward. To be the Son is to be loved by the Father. To be the Son is to be close enough to the Father to see what the Father does, and to be the Son is to then do what the Father does. And the result of this is that life comes to those who are around the Son. Right? When we focus on the actual details of the way that Jesus describes this sonship, there's nothing in here about being divine. There's nothing about being God. Being the Son of God is about being loved by God and doing the Father's will so that those around you are blessed. Jesus is going to later explain why the people don't understand this. So that in verse 36, Jesus says, "For the works that the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I am doing, they bear witness about me that the Father has sent me." In other words, what Jesus is saying is, you see what I'm doing, right? Like, I am out here in public. I'm doing all of these things. You have seen it. I am doing the will of the Father. This is why I can be called God's Son. And then Jesus says, the Father who sent me has himself announced that this is what the Son would come and do. But you, Jesus says, you have never clearly heard his voice. You've clearly never seen the Father. His word cannot be in you, because if it were, you would believe me, because you would recognize what you're seeing in me as the works of the Father's. But you search the scriptures, Jesus says, but you've somehow clearly missed the main message. Even though you say that you trust Moses and you trust his words, Moses stands and he accuses you because you have not understood. You don't know what you're looking at. What in the world is all of this about? I mean, Jesus has just gone on this like extended monologue to this crowd. What is he saying? All this talk about the Son of God and the Father and the scriptures and Moses, like, how are these all related? And what is the Gospel of John trying to reveal to us? And I believe it's this: the people of God, Israel, claim that they trust Moses, that they follow Moses and his teachings, which is why they're then upset about Jesus healing on the Sabbath, right? And they are concerned when they think that Jesus is making himself equal to God. But Jesus tells his people that they do not understand Moses, that they do not actually trust Moses. And the evidence that they don't trust Moses is standing right in front of them in the person of Jesus. They look at Jesus and they do not recognize him. They do not see what Jesus is doing or hear what Jesus is saying and recognize it as the works of the Father, as the words of the Father. And the fact that they do not recognize Jesus actually reveals how truly lost they are. And I want to give you a quick and kind of definitely absurd example. So say you get hired somewhere, and you could pick any job, but this one I kind of thought through. You get hired as a mail carrier, super random. And one time, a long time ago, you saw on some show, there was a guy who was a mail carrier who collected mail and then had like this portable shredder that he would shred all of the mail. Like, and you saw this, it was like on a show, there was a mail carrier, he did this. And so in your mind, you have always thought of mail carriers shredding everyone's mail. Absurd. But fast forward, and now you get hired and you begin to collect mail from the post office, from mailboxes, and you bring along your own personal shredder and you begin to shred everyone's mail. Because like, you think that this is the job that you've been hired to do. But when you got the job, you're like, you even got a job description. Somebody gave you a job description that said, this is what mail carriers do. And you read the job description and you thought it was weird. And in fact, you like kept reading it every day. Maybe it'll make more sense over time, but it doesn't really seem to like make more sense, because you know in your mind what the job is. And so you keep doing it and you keep shredding mail. And that just means that there are certain instructions in the job description that you just sort of ignore because they just don't make sense. But after a short while, Like, you can't imagine that your boss would let you get away with this for very long. He's concerned, and he's getting a lot of complaints. People aren't getting their mail. And so he sends someone on your route with you. And the guy who travels the route with you is clearly mortified by what he sees. And so he says, tomorrow, I'm running your route. You're watching me. And so the next day, you ride along and you watch. And now you're mortified. What in the world is this guy doing? What an idiot. He doesn't know how this job is done. All he's doing is exchanging letters from like one box to the other. He clearly doesn't understand the job. The job is clearly about collecting and shredding. This guy has it all wrong. You can see how absurd this example is. But I think it's a necessary one, because when God's people who read Moses all the time were ready to kill a man for calling God their father. Like, they clearly have an absurd view of their own place in the world, their role in it, and their relationship with God. Their view of themselves couldn't be more absurd. Because in the book of Exodus, in one of the earliest interactions between God and Moses, God says to Moses, Moses, your job is to go to Pharaoh, and you will say to Pharaoh, the Lord says, Israel is my firstborn son. You will let my son go so that he may serve me. God comes to his people in slavery, and he identifies himself as their father, as the father of these people. They are his firstborn son. And so can you hear Jesus? What is a son except someone who serves or does the will of his father? And then later in the First Testament, one of the prophets, Hosea, will share some words from God, and God will say, when Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. Can you hear some more of Jesus in this? What is a son except someone who is loved by his father? In Hosea, God, many, many, many years later, is recalling and reminding his people of the loving way that he chose Israel to be his son. He set his son free, invited his son to come and to be in his presence, to hear his words, to seek his works, and to do his will. When God rescues his son from Egypt, God is simply fulfilling the promise that he made to Abraham many, many, many years earlier, that he would fill the earth with his children. God is taking Abraham's family, and he is preparing to raise them up as his own son in the world, a son who will be a blessing to the world. The issue isn't that Jesus calls God Father. The issue is that the Israelites don't. He is their father. Israel has been hired for the job of being God's firstborn son. Israel's been chosen among all nations to do the work of being a blessing to the nation, to the nations, to the world, of bringing life to the nations. But somewhere along the way, Israel missed the memo. Israel is working with a different understanding of the job that he's been chosen for. And so even with a full-on job description given to them by Moses, they don't seem to understand their role as the son of God. And so the Gospel of John tells us that God does something about this. That God takes on flesh to come and to live among his people. God has come near to show his people what it looks like to live out their sonship. He is with them so that they can see what it looks like to be a blessing to the world. But the people don't understand, right? Because where God intended Sabbath to be a blessing, the people have turned Sabbath into a burden, into a curse. And so the Son of God sees the work of his Father and he does the same work, right? Jesus uses the Sabbath the same way that his Father uses it, the way that it was meant to be used. Jesus blesses on the Sabbath. Jesus restores on the Sabbath. Jesus makes whole and he heals on the Sabbath. And the people want to kill him for it because, right, their understanding of their work is so distorted. They want to shred mail. They were hired to deliver. And so they want to kill a man who calls God his Father. Even though this is the privilege that God has given to them. Right? I mean, think about this, that they would call God their Father, that they would seek him, that they would draw near to him, that they would do his will, bringing life and blessing and abundance to the whole world. Like, as God's firstborn son, Israel had been chosen not to be God's only son, but to be the firstborn of sons who would then invite all other nations to come and find their life in their Creator. This is the great tragedy of Israel's life and story. Having been given this great privilege, they squander it. So that when God himself shows up to show them how it's done, like, they cannot even recognize the Father's works. The people see the things that Jesus is doing, and they cannot see in Jesus the power of God or the mercy of God. All they can see is Jesus breaking rules, rules that they have misunderstood and sort of elevated to ultimate value. God longs for Israel to call him Father, and instead they want to kill him as he walks with them and shows them how to be a faithful son. The Gospel of John opened, we heard this a couple weeks ago, by telling us that Jesus has come so that everyone, every single person who would receive him, all who would believe in his name, will know that they have been given the right to become children of God. We were made to be God's children. We were made to live as God's children. When humanity went astray, rejecting God's fatherhood, God did not abandon the world. God did not abandon humanity. Instead, God chose Israel as his firstborn son to show off his character, to show off his love, to invite those who had gone astray to return to the love of the Father. Because to call God your Father is not to make yourself equal to God. It is to understand what you were made for. To call God your Father is to understand what you were made for. And this is the good news. That when Israel fell short, just as all of humanity before, God didn't abandon Israel. Where Israel took for granted the call to be the firstborn, where Israel misunderstood its calling, where Israel failed to bless the nations and to invite the world into the life that the Father offers. Where Israel failed, God succeeded. Jesus stepped in and stood in Israel's place and fulfilled Israel's mission so that the entire world might be blessed, so that all might know that they have been given the right to be children of God. Where Israel was supposed to be the light to the world, Jesus came and shone brightly in her place, shining brightly on Israel as well as the world. Where Israel was supposed to be the Son of God, serving the Father in the world, Jesus came and did God's will even unto death. Where Israel was supposed to show off the character of her God, a God who was abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, Jesus came and suffered and died and showed us what God is like. Jesus showed us the unrivaled love of the Father. And so to return to our opening question about the foundation of our faith, if we are looking for signs or voices or evidence or experiences to stand as a solid basis for our faith, we are always going to find these lacking. These might supplement our faith, but they can never hold it up. The foundation of our faith is that Jesus was chosen to fulfill the great promises of God. And that through the obedience of the Son who knew his Father's love deeply and who did the Father's will to the very end, that through the Son, we have been given the right to be children of God. Through Jesus, we have been given an example for how to live as God's children. And with the Spirit of Jesus, we have been given the power to live as God's children. And if the Son truly knows the Father, and if the Son has truly set us free, then his words are good and they are trustworthy. So as Jesus says in chapter 5, verse 24, truly, truly, I say to you, whoever hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life. Today, Jesus has spoken to us that life as children of God is available to all of us. Sons and daughters of God, look like Jesus, the Son of God, who drew near to the Father, who listened to his voice, who did his will, who blessed the world around them. And this morning, the Father is inviting us to respond. The Father is inviting us to join him at his table, to draw near to him, to listen to his voice, to do his will, and to reflect on the good and obedient Son who was given for our salvation, who was given for our life, to set us free so that we too could be children of the Father.